The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So welcome. It's nice to be here. See you all. So it's not a surprise, I think all of us know this, that we often find ourselves looking outside of ourselves to define success or happiness. This isn't news. You wouldn't be here if you hadn't quite noticed that. That we're always like, not always, but very often thinking that things that are out there are going to define our success or make us happy. And of course, material wealth is often a definition of success. We see this a lot, right, in the media and certainly in politics and all kinds of arenas, right? And as we practice, the more we practice, the more we hang around Dharma centers, the more we meditate, our perspectives start to shift. As we start to have more experiences of calmness, of ease, well-being, and peace, we start to value that. And some of our perspectives on our definitions of success or happiness start to shift. Maybe it's subtle in the beginning. Maybe it's dramatic. But there is a change that often happens as the more that we practice and the more experience we have. I'll say that's certainly what has been true for me with all this retreat practice, spending all these hours in meditation. Just so much my idea of what I need to be happy has really changed. You know, for those of you who've been on retreat, you know that you live very simply in this tiny little room, right, with just a few belongings, and you don't get to choose when you're going to eat or what you're going to eat or when you're going to meditate or not meditate, those types of things. And there can be such a sense of contentment, actually, like, okay, this is it. I don't have to worry about all that other stuff because it's not going to happen. I just have this experience. And somehow just kind of like giving over to that is refreshing and welcoming. So it's kind of has shifted my way that I think about what it means to be happy and what are the definitions of success. I also have this story that had such a big impact on me. It's quite many years ago now, but it still had such an impact on me that I still think about it sometimes. This was when I was finally out of school and had my first real job. And one of my first paychecks, I bought a jacket that I really couldn't afford. But I felt fabulous when I put it on, right? I felt like, okay, I have to have this jacket, and doesn't matter, I can't quite afford it, but I'm going to buy it, right? I have a job now, right? And so I purchase it, very happily wear it soon thereafter to go out with one of my friends, and we were going out to dinner. Wearing my jacket, I love it. Okay, we're at the restaurant. I'm like, uh-oh, what do I do with this jacket? I don't want to wear it, because what if I spill something on it? I don't want to put it on the back of the chair, because what if somebody else spills something on it? They don't have a coat rack. What if somebody takes it? Like, this jacket became a thing of, like, obsession with me. Instead of me owning the jacket, it ended up the jacket was owning me. I couldn't hang it up in a way that would get squished in my closet. I couldn't, you know, all these ways that having something that I couldn't quite afford, I ended up being so contracted around it. So instead of it providing the happiness that I thought it was going to, it ended up providing a lot of suffering. And which then I felt like, oh, I shouldn't have really spent this money for this thing, right? Perhaps you have your own version of a story of like this, right? You're convinced something is going to be... Now I kind of joke, and I actually do say this to myself. I must have this. I know this will be a source of lasting happiness, right? Because it's ridiculous when you say that out loud. Things, objects are not sources of lasting happiness. But they may bring pleasure. They may bring momentary happiness, of course. They are not sources of lasting happiness. So there is a story kind of buried in the suttas. That is the discourses, like the scriptures, if you will, of early Buddhism, upon which this tradition that we practice here is based. And it's a story that I hadn't heard before, and I just stumbled upon recently, and I was kind of charmed by it. I'd like to share it with you. And the story is, it's a collection of verses, and it's a conversation between Daniya, who is a householder, and the Buddha. And Daniya is a person you'll see as I share the verses with you, who has everything. A nice house, a great job, a good relationship. His family lives nearby and they're healthy. Everybody's healthy. And he just feels happy and secure and comfortable. Like he's made it, he has it, he has everything. And in fact, his name, Daniya, could be loosely translated as the rich guy. Because Dana is the word for wealthy or riches. So he's like the kind of the rich guy. We see this a lot actually in the suttas, that people's names are, like an attribute that they may have or something like this. So Daniya is a cattleman or a rancher, or I don't know if he has a ranch per se, but owns cattle. So his wealth is in his cattle. And remember, this is in ancient India, thousands of years ago, and it's before the monsoon season. And Daniya has spent time to prepare for the monsoons. He knows they're coming, and he's feeling satisfied, like, okay, I'm all set, bring it on. So these verses, each stanza ends with his saying to the rain god, it's okay if it rains, I'm ready, essentially. And if you have trouble relating to Daniya, who has his wealth in cattle and he's worried about the rain, then maybe when you hear these verses, you could substitute instead of cattle something like stocks and bonds or houses or whatever, you know, for you is wealth. And instead of rain, maybe you could think of like an economic downturn or something like that. There's maybe some modern contemporary equivalents, or I don't know, some way to think about it. So first I'll read what Daniya says, and then I'll flesh it out, and then I'll say how the Buddha responds. So here's Daniya. I've boiled my rice, I've milked the cows, I dwell with my family near the bank of the Mahi, my hut is thatched, the fire is kindled. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. He's just saying, right, I'm ready. I have my house, is all set. No gadflies or mosquitoes are found. The cows roam in the meadow, lush with grass. They can endure when the rain when it comes. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. My wife is obedient and not careless. Living together with me long, she is agreeable, and I do not hear any evil about her. So, if you wish, pour down, O sky god. I am employed by myself, and my children living close by are healthy. I do not hear any evil about them either. So, if you wish, pour down, O sky god. There are cows and suckling calves. There are cows with calf and breeding cows. There's also a bull, chief of cattle, here. So, if you wish, pour down, O sky god. And here's the last verse. The stakes are planted, unshakable. The munja grass halters are new and well-shaped. Not even the suckling cow can break them. So, if you wish, pour down, O sky god. Right, all these different ways. He's just kind of reflecting on how he's feeling secure and safe and has what he thinks is important to him. So what I omitted is the Buddha has a response to each of these verses. And we could take the Buddha's responses literally or metaphorically. And it can be fun and interesting to think about both. Like maybe it's literally true, or maybe he's referring to something else. And to help us with this, kind of the some of the metaphorical understandings that may be there, we can refer to the commentaries, quote-unquote, the commentaries. That is, this is a body of work that was composed about, you know, roughly 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. And these commentaries, like, augment the meaning. They kind of, like, flesh it out, like, what was meant in the suttas. And they often provide very colorful backstories about all the characters. And, like, why does this happen and what was it really meant or something like this. So even though the commentaries are 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha, they're still, you know, closer to the Buddha than we are. And I'll say that Theravada Buddhism in Burma and Sri Lanka really hold the commentaries as authoritative, whereas Theravada Buddhism in Thailand doesn't. And here, like at IMC, most of our the teachers here don't are more interested in what the suttas say than what the commentaries say. So I just say that as a way for us to just hold these lightly. Maybe it's fun and instructional to hear what they have to say. Before I do that, though, I just wanted to appreciate that how much our worldviews change just simply with time. Right? I'm talking about some of those thousands of years ago. So here is a translation. I'll just do a verse or two of exactly what I just read. So it's the same Pali, the same underlying language, but it was translated by somebody who was born in 1871, right? So it has a very different feel. I'll just read a verse or two here. Cooked is the evening rice, all milked the kine, by Mahi's banks with friends, good cheer is mine. My house well thatched, my fire glows bright and still, and so rain on, O sky, if such thy will. Right? There's a particular meter, and it rhymes, and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, 150 years ago, almost, they when they saw a verse, they were translating it with meter and rhyme. But now, what I just read you is closer to actually what the Pali has to say and doesn't have the meter or rhyme. So that's just how things have changed in 150 years. If we think about, you know, thousands of years, that can, just gives us something to think about how I'm talking about how our perceptions change with practice, but also just, you know, the zeitgeist changes with time, right? Here in 2018, we think about the teachings different than they did in 1918, if they were back there, whenever. Okay, so here's getting back to what Daniya says and then how the Buddha responds. So here's Daniya again. I've boiled my rice, I've milked the cows, I dwell with my family near the bank of the Mahi. My hut is thatched, the fire is kindled, so if you wish, pour down, O sky god. So the commentaries say that the Buddha heard this with his divine ears and sensed that this person was ready for his awakening, was open to some teachings. So the Buddha, in some way, goes there to where Daniya is and says this to him. Let's see here, sorry. I don't boil with anger. I'm rid of barrenness. I dwell one night near the bank of the Mahi. My hut open, my fire extinguished. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. So the Buddha is saying he's exact opposite of what Daniya is saying. Daniya is saying, I've boiled my rice. And the Buddha is saying, I don't boil with anger. So the commentaries tell us that this boiling rice refers to Daniya's saying, we could understand this more generally, is he's taken care of his physical suffering, of what his body needs. But this needs to be done repeatedly, right? We have to eat over and over and over again. So this is a type of suffering, quote-unquote, I'm using this word lightly, that type of stress maybe, that just is always recurring. So even though we may have eaten a meal, we'll be hungry again, right? We have to take care of this. But the Buddha is saying, I do not boil with anger. So he has gotten rid of anger, and he's taken care of his mental suffering. And he's done it once and for all. It's not just a temporary thing that has happened, but instead he has gotten rid of something that causes a lot of discord and a lot of discomfort and a lot of difficulty in our lives. So Daniya said, I've milked the cows. And the Buddha says, I'm rid of barrenness. So Daniya saying, I've milked the cows, is referring to that he's done his job. He's taken care of what needed to be done, he's taken care of his responsibilities. Whereas the Buddha saying, I'm rid of barrenness, he refers to that if the idea of being barren is that even if you are doing wholesome practices or cultivating wholesome qualities, you're not feeling the fruits of them. You're not getting the fruits of some of the positive activities that you've done either physically or mentally. And implicit in this is that's the most important job. It's more important than taking care of what whatever the daily task is to make it so that your activities that you do can bear fruit, positive fruit. And the so the Buddha, implicit in this, is the idea of saying that Daniya is rejoicing, thinking that all the work is done. The Buddha is saying there's still more work to do. You can prepare your mind. This is still more work to do. This is a worthwhile endeavor. Daniya says, I dwell with my family near the bank of the Mahi. Implicit as this is that being tied to a single location can be a source of suffering. It doesn't always mean security. In fact, it can be awful, you know, certain times in certain situations. It can be security, but it isn't always. And specifically, if the monsoons come and it floods, and Daniya did not choose a good place to put his house, then he and all of his wealth go, right? They get flooded and go away. So the Buddha is kind of pointing out to the, Daniya isn't as secure as perhaps he thinks that he is. And the Buddha responds, I dwell one night near the bank of the Mahi. And the Buddha is saying that because he has the freedom to come and go where he pleases, he is able to help and serve and support so many people, not being just tied to a single location. So not only does he have security, but he's able to support lots of people. So we don't have to take these literally in that we shouldn't live in a single place and we shouldn't have a job, but we can just think about, you know, for ourselves, what are some things that we are holding on to thinking that they're going to make us secure, that maybe aren't as secure as we think they are? Or are there things, work that we have done, to like, okay, that's enough, that's good enough. But is there more work that can be done, maybe a different way? Are we resting on our laurels when perhaps it isn't right to do that? Maybe it's not the right time to do that. So Daniya says, my hut is thatched. In the suttas, we see that the word hut also refers to one's body. And to be thatched often means to be covered. But in the suttas, the covering is often craving or conceit or holding on tightly to views. That's what kind of we get wrapped up in. And kind of our, you know, sometimes our bodies get physically tight too, right? If we're really grabbing on to views or conceit. And if you're covered with a craving, conceit, and or views, you're not protected from defilements from that may arise from inside. So even though you may think that you have some covering, you have some protection, you actually aren't, from those things that come from within. And then if you're filled with those defilements, it's not true happiness. You may have some pleasure, you may have a certain amount of ease, but it's not the highest happiness if you still have craving, conceit, and views that you're really holding on to tightly. So the Buddha says, my hut, open, saying, referring to that his defilements have been destroyed, and therefore he doesn't have to worry about them leaking in. It's not possible, and that he's experiencing the highest happiness because the defilements are no longer visiting. Daniya says, the fire is kindled. Often we think of fire as something cozy and we want to, you know, get up close to and warm our hearths, which is true, it does that. But also fires, perhaps some of you may be familiar with the fire sermon that's in the Buddhist teachings, which I won't go into now, that talks about how often we have things that are like burning us up inside, let's just say that. And specifically, we could say some of them are greed, hatred, and delusion. These are, that are the roots of so many difficulties that we may have. So fire may refer to those things that actually lead to a lot of suffering. So Daniya is saying, my fire is kindled, and then Buddha is saying, my fire is extinguished. So when the Buddha is saying to the sky god, if you wish, pour down, he's implying that it's okay for those individuals who are similar to him and have gotten rid of suffering, achieved the highest happiness, and done what is needed to be done, to be cavalier about the upcoming rains. They don't have to worry about what's going to happen. They have the capacity and the capability to meet anything and everything. Whereas those like Daniya, whose well-being is actually dependent on the rain, right? If you are a cattle person, if there is no rain, therefore no grass, you have a problem. And if there's too much rain and floods, you also have a problem. So Daniya continues, no gadflies or mosquitoes are found. The cows roam in the meadow lush with grass. They can endure the rain when it comes. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. The Buddha responds, I made a raft that is well constructed. I have crossed, gone beyond, escaped the flood, and now I have no more need for a raft. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. So the Buddha's response may feel like a non sequitur. Like, what? He's talking about a raft, and Daniya is talking about the cows roaming in with the grass. There's three ways we could think about this. One is some scholars have postulated that, well, maybe there's some verses that are missing, like that they just didn't get transmitted, got lost somehow, right, over these thousands of years, and there should be something else in there that makes sense of why the Buddha is talking about a raft. The second is we could say there's could be a play on words. The Pali word for grass is tina. The Pali word for raft is tina. So tina, tina. Maybe there's like a little play on words going on in the Pali. So that's why he's saying that. And maybe we could take it a little bit more literally, or maybe not literally, but saying that Daniya is thinking that he has everything that he needs. The cows have grass and there aren't mosquitoes that are troublesome. And the Buddha is saying, I had what I needed, but I don't need it anymore. I had a raft, I crossed over, and now I don't need a raft. So Daniya may believe that his wealth is in a safe location. But maybe it isn't. And the Buddha is also saying that the Buddha himself is more secure and comfortable than Daniya and his cows and his cattle. So even though they are feeling like they have everything they need and aren't pestered by gadflies and mosquitoes, they could be more comfortable. They could be more secure. That's what the Buddha is saying. And for those of you that like the floods off, for those of you who are maybe some of you may be familiar with this, the floods are often used as a symbol in the Buddhist teachings for the floods of desire or the floods of views or the floods of ignorance. So these are things that we cross over to get to the other shore where we don't have those things. So it's kind of a certain symbolism to that as well. Yeah, so this next one is, I looked at a number of different translations and they all kind of say the same. And I admit that I feel a little bit like uncomfortable with this. But the truth is, there's a certain amount of androcentrism in these early teachers. It's about men and men's relationships with other people. There's a lot of that are preserved in the suttas. Maybe it's not surprising, right? Most religious traditions have this, and these scriptures were preserved by men, too. They're preserved by monks. So maybe that's not exactly what was said. There's no way for us to know. But we do know over the millennia, them being preserved by men, they have definitely a masculine feel to them. So Daniya says, "My wife is obedient." Okay. "My wife is obedient and not careless. Living together with me long, she is agreeable, and I do not hear any evil about her. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god." The Buddha responds, "My mind is obedient and liberated. It's long been nurtured and well tamed, and no evil is found in me. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god." Right, again, we can see where here's Daniya thinking like, oh, okay, something out there is agreeable, is how we would want it to be. Sounds like he has a relationship that he appreciates. He measures it by obedience, but the commentaries make the comment, yeah, if somebody behaves a particular way, do we really know what's in their minds? Do we really know what's in their minds all the time? Do we really know why they're doing everything they're doing? So pointing to, yes, there is value and it's legitimate that to see how somebody behaves, but it's not the same as knowing of their minds, what's inside their minds. And of course, it's not the same of having your own mind be obedient, quote-unquote. The commentaries say that what the Buddha meant by this is that his mind is under the control, but he is not controlled by his mind. Sometimes we feel like we're pushed around by our thoughts and our feelings, our moods, our emotions, right? That happens often enough. And so implicit in what the Buddha is saying here, that since the Buddha has removed the bondage, essentially, of the defilements, it is his mind, not Daniya's wife, that is really obedient. And Daniya says about his wife, "Living together with me long, she is agreeable." And the Buddha says, referring to his mind, "It's been long nurtured and well tamed." So the Buddha is referring to this, specifically they say, you know, in the kind of Buddhist cosmology was the idea that the Buddha had many, many lifetimes before he became awakened. And they're saying during those lifetimes, he was nurturing, quote-unquote, his mind with generosity and good behavior. So in some way, kind of consistently practicing that, now his mind doesn't waver. It helped create the conditions, for him to become awakened and to be well-tamed. Therefore, the Buddha's mind is agreeable more than Daniya's wife is agreeable. And then the Buddha also says, no evil is found in me. Also referring to the time before the Buddha was awakened, that he didn't do evil acts. Even in his last lifetime, whether or not you believe this is not so important, it's just the idea that what we do has consequences. So the story is that the Buddha, before he became a Buddha, when he was just a person, I guess he was a person after he was awakened too, but before he was an awakened person, that he didn't do any, didn't break any precepts. He only did skillful things, even when he was living in this house in the lap of luxury. So it's only of my mind, not your wife, that it's impossible to hear of any evil. Just saying that even though we may think, you know, people are a certain way, we never really know. Again, I think the Buddha is just pointing to Daniya. Maybe your security and your comfort isn't as secure and comfortable as you think it is. Maybe if you put all your sense of happiness and things, these things being this particular way, there can be more security, more comfort, more happiness. So then, I don't think I'll go through all of these. I'll do one more set here. Daniya says, I am employed by myself and my children living close by are healthy. I do not hear any evil about them. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. The Buddha responds, I am not employed by anyone. I wander in all the world by what I've earned. I have no need at all for wages. So if you wish, pour down, O sky god. Right, so Daniya is feeling like he's independent, like he has his own, right, he doesn't have a boss. But to the Buddha saying, actually, I'm more independent. I can travel around wherever he wants. And that he is not an employee of anyone, not even a sense of self. Right? Often we create this sense of self that pushes us around. I want to be seen as a person who is nice, therefore I have to behave in this particular way. I want to be seen as a person who, whatever our sense of self may be, that kind of pushes us around. Even though we may not notice it, but it often does, our kind of trying to support a particular sense of self. So the Buddha is saying he doesn't even have that as an employer, quote unquote. And the Buddha is also saying that even though Daniya thinks that he is independent because he doesn't have a boss, essentially, Daniya is still a slave, quote unquote, in some regards, because he is a slave to his own craving, to his own ideas that he's clinging to, things that he wants. So even though Daniya is feeling like he has freedom in his professional life, let's say, doesn't mean he has complete freedom. And when the Buddha is saying that I have no need at all for wages, he is saying, because there is nothing further to be done, there's no need to be an employee of anything, of anyone. He has complete independence. And of course, he's a mendicant. So his life could not be much simpler, right? That he just has his robes and his alms bowl. And if people give food to him, he eats. And if people don't give food to him, he doesn't eat. It's very simple. And the Buddha feels comfortable with that. So he's not always striving to get more and more and more. He doesn't have that feeling. So there's a few more verses that go on, but rather than going through all of them, I can kind of summarize it saying that Daniya, right, is feeling secure and happy, comfortable, feeling like he had everything that he wanted. But with every verse, everything that Daniya states, then the Buddha has a rejoinder, right, just saying, yes, but there's more. Yes, this is good that you have this. It's not saying that it's wrong or it's bad. He's saying, but there's more work that can be done. There can be more security, more happiness, more comfort. Don't just rest on these things that were these acquisitions that are externally that you have out there and the relationships that you have. So part of the end here that I didn't read earlier is after Daniya says all these verses and then the Buddha responds, then it goes on to say, filling the lowland and the highland at once, a great cloud poured down rain. Having heard the rain falling, Daniya spoke. It is indeed no small gain for us that we have seen the Blessed One, the Buddha. We approach you as refuge, one with vision. Be our teacher, great sage. My wife and I, obedient, so now both of them are going to be obedient. My wife and I, obedient, would lead the spiritual life under the Fortunate One. Gone beyond birth and death, we will make an end to suffering. So there's something in what the Buddha was saying that really struck Daniya. He realized, oh, there's some truth here, that this comfort and happiness isn't everything. There's something more. And maybe seeing what the Buddha had, I haven't been in the presence of a Buddha, but maybe as the Buddha was saying or pointing out that he doesn't have any defilements or he doesn't have any bondage or he doesn't have any evil, maybe that was really evident. Maybe somehow they could sense that or intuit that and say, oh, it is possible. It is possible. And so they felt inspired and took refuge, which just became followers of him and decided to practice the spiritual life. So I kind of liked this story because we often don't hear stories of somebody who's happy and satisfied and the Buddha goes to talk to them. Often there's, trouble or something like this. And I liked the kind of looking at the commentary, seeing that there's so many different ways that we can understand things. We don't have to take them literally. We can think about, for us as individuals, how can we understand this and how can it apply to us, our own lives? What have we been holding on that we think is going to make us happy and secure and comfortable? What work do we think that we have finished, or perhaps there's a little bit more attention that we can pay, a little more work we can do, or more ways that we can pay attention? So for the remaining time, I'd like to open it up for some comments or questions. And we'll use the microphone.
That's a great story. Your commentary seems to be that when we think that we have our needs met and we have what we want and we're clinging to it because there's attachment to those things, which the landholder seems to have a lot of, there is more than that because we can let go of that clinging and find more freedom. I'm wondering if the commentaries also reflect the idea that there is of a relative reality of the physical world and our dependence on those things in the world for our happiness and situations and attachment to them versus absolute reality, which the Buddha dwells in, that is a maybe a land of or a state of more freedom and happiness, and that particular contrast.
Yeah, thank you. That's an interesting question, Randy. So the time of the Buddha, and in the suttas, there's very, very little reference to that. There's there's some suttas that maybe you could interpret that way or not, kind of absolute reality, ultimate and relative or something like this. And then the commentaries are commenting like word for word. They're taking the suttas and say the suttas have these specific words and here's how to understand them. So they're very intimately tied with that. This idea of the relative and the absolute happened, a couple hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And then it went a little bit different direction. So the commentaries on the suttas don't really include that. You'll find it more in, not in the Theravada, not in this particular Pali canon. You'll find it more in the, probably, well, certainly in Nagarjuna's teachings, probably you're familiar with, which are a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And then they went up into Asia, of course they're in Asia, but more like China. And then in China, they really started to kind of flourish some more after starting in India. Does that answer your question?
Well, you began by talking about the commentaries that were written like 1,000 years, more or less, after the Buddha. So I assume that the reflections that you are referring to have to do with those commentaries that were written much later. Is that
I didn't follow.
Correct? You began, you said that
so these
you're talking about the commentaries on the sutta.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering if those commentaries that happened, that were written much later, have that perspective as well? Are they still being dealing with literal
terms? So kind of what happened then, here's a little, like a little Buddhist studies thing, is that a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha, I'll kind of grossly simplify this, Nagarjuna, one particular teacher, who takes one little tiny aspect of the suttas and just really goes with it and creates this, something that's really... it's related to this tiny little thing with the suttas, but then makes a bigger philosophy that includes things, lots of things that are not in the sutta. And then there's commentary on that commentary, and then there's commentary on that commentary on that commentary. And then that's where we start to really get to this with the relative and the absolute. Is that what you were saying, what you were thinking? Yeah. It's fascinating, how this all works. Because, of course, time is happening, as I'm talking about, but also location, whether this is in India or in China or elsewhere in East Asia or Central Asia or Southeast Asia, right? They all had their own cultures, of course. And so they had their own views. And so how they interpreted things and what they thought was the most important was different in all these different locations and, of course, different in all this different time. So that's why you have such a wide range of teachings. But here at IMC, we stick primarily with what's in the Pali Canon.
So... I definitely appreciated the story. I like the way that it gives a comparison of, say, a lay person and then an enlightened view of it. And, what I just kind of noticed was that Daniya, all of his joy came from outside sources.
Yeah.
And then the Buddha wanted to shed some light that all of his joy came from within.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of another thing was like all of Daniya's security came from all the things that he had, all the possessions. And because all of his ducks were in a row, he felt very secure. But what happens when the flood comes in and removes all of those securities that he has?
Yeah.
Is he still going to be okay?
Yeah. And
so where the Buddha was saying was that let the flood come. And even if it comes and takes away what little I have, I'll still feel liberated. I'll still feel joy.
Nice.
So I did like that.
Fantastic. That's a beautiful summary. I love it. Thank you. Thank you.
It also makes me wonder as well, and I struggle with this, you know, within my practice and with everyday life, the world that's maybe not the real world, but how do you live enlightened? How do you live not needing possessions in a world where so much is reliant on those things?
Yeah.
And so sometimes I struggle, like, if I'm meditating in the forest, I think I could do it. But I live here where, you know, the people who have the most ego seems to be more successful. The people who have more things get more things. And the people who have little seem to get less. So I always wonder how I can live with my practice and, you know, still feel that, you know, I'm doing the right thing. And I know it comes from within. And just within my practice, I understand about being free of those things, like in this story, will give you that ultimate joy that you don't need those things. And so you can continue to, you know, live life in the present and not worry about those things. So, I don't know.
Yeah, so you'll notice in the story, the Buddha isn't saying, get rid of your cattle, get rid of your wife, who cares about your kids? He's not saying that. He's just pointing out, if you think all your security and comfort is going to come from here, you're going to be disappointed. So he's not saying get rid of things. He's saying, look at your relationship to them. Are you attached to them in such a way that you think your well-being is dependent on them? And we probably all know people, either personally or in the media, who have so much money, and yet they need more money, right? And then they need more money and more money, right? So this idea that somehow you can, it's enough and you'll be satisfied, we see that playing out, that it doesn't really work. Maybe we see that for ourselves too. We get a big raise, oh wait, it's still not quite enough, we just have to buy more expensive items or something like this. So that's one thing, is that it's for us to kind of change what we're expecting from our material goods, from the things out there. Are we expecting them to deliver this well-being that doesn't go away? We're going to be disappointed. And then there was a second thing I was going to say that just left my mind. Sorry.
Sure.
One thing that occurs to me with this is that Daniya is somebody who's pretty high up in the Maslow's hierarchy. He's got everything. He's got his act together. He's a responsible citizen. He's taking care of business. And they start by talking about that you have mentioned that Daniya was ripe for some sort of opening. And part of that ability to see is when you've done all that you can to make yourself safe. At that point, you're able to see that there is a possibility of more because there's no scrabbling for something else. And I think that, you know, a lot of religions have people transformed by suffering. You know, they'll take somebody who's in an extraordinary circumstance, and that person is the person who will you know, be consumed by flame. But here's an ordinary person who's, like, doing his job and paying attention and taking care of business. And it's like, hey, but wait, there's more. It's, you think you got it good now, Dania. Just look at this. It's like, so there's that discontent that you can come upon by having everything that you want. It's like all the people who, you know, they get their first job and all of a sudden, you know, they have their first couple of kids. Why am I depressed? What more could I possibly want in this world than what is happening to me right now? Mm-hmm. You know, so he really is like a really good example for the modern man, mm-hmm. the modern striving man, mm-hmm. because that person would have the ability to see that, oh, things are a little off. They could be better, even though things are might as well be perfect.
Yeah, I think so often, right? If we're feeling some discontent, oh, it's just because I need this other thing. More money, a better relationship, better house, I don't know, whatever it is, right? But if you've already got all those things, then you maybe you're ripe for like, oh, okay. It's not just going to be this something out there that's going to be satisfying. Always want more. It's quite something, right? We always want more. So it's 9:01, so I'm going to let you go. I'll stay up here if somebody wants to come and talk to me. But may you find some inner comfort and security and happiness that really supports you. Thank you.